come to order. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here, and we'll do our best to expedite the process. Everybody has a chance to speak on the topic that you're interested in. I want to announce that House Bill 3491 will not be heard today. That will be moved to Friday. That will be a public hearing on Friday. So that will not be in work session today. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2967. Committee, this is the regulatory flexibility bill that we passed to the floor. The presenters of the bill feel that the fiscal is too high, and so they would like to bring it back to committee and amend it to lower the fiscal. Yeah. So, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House. Can I do this if I didn't vote on the prevailing side, though? I can't.
I believe so. Okay. This is a motion.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2967.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2967. Are there objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2967 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum's move that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2967 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Are there objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments were adopted into House Bill 2967.
Representative Rosenbaum moves we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments were adopted into House Bill 2967. Are there objections? None so ordered.
Now we're back to just the original bill.
Okay. We're going to call up J.L. Wilson and have him explain the new amendment to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. One more time. House Bill 2967. The Dash 2 amendments are in response to the fiscal note that was prepared for House Bill 2967, which came in after the bill was passed. It indicated a $53,702 general fund impact and an other funds impact, DCBS, of just over $197,000. That was in the form of two FTE increase, the services and supplies associated with the FTE, as well as defending court cases in case judicial review was invoked under this measure. So the Dash 2 amendments do the following. Just like the Dash 1s, they define a small business as having 100 employees or less, not the original 500 that was in the bill. Section 4, judicial review, is completely deleted, so there is no judicial review that can be invoked in Section 4 upon somebody feeling that a department did not do an adequate job of doing an impact analysis. In Section 5, Sub 3, again, the Economic Community Development Department and their role in assisting is deleted, and also judicial review under Section 5 under the alternative analysis is deleted. So judicial review under both sections is deleted from the bill. The fiscal impact stated that there was an estimate of 150 to 200 hours of Attorney General services required because of judicial review. I had to pick what was a priority to me. The impact analysis and the flexibility analysis are my priority. Judicial review is not. So judicial review is removed from the bill entirely. But the big cost saver that is in the bill is the three-year rule review is deleted. I talked with what was originally what I thought was a mistake in the bill. It turned out that my instincts were correct, and that component is not worth as much to me as the upfront analysis as required by this bill. So it's a trade-off, but if there's one thing I'm quite sure of, and that is that three-year rule review costs a heck of a lot more than $250,000 a biennium. So That's the impact of the amendments. I believe that the bill should now save money as opposed to cost money if everything washes out as it should. So that being said, I'll be happy to answer any questions about the bill, about the amendments, and I would urge your adoption of the dash twos and subsequent adoption of the measure to the floor.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, JL. The fiscal analysis that's in front of us talks about the Bureau of Labor and Industries and then DCVS. And do these amendments address those agencies?
Thank you. Chair Close and Representative Rosenbaum, I can't speak to whether they here's what I'm guessing, that the rule review primarily comes out of DCBS. So the $197,478 impact on other funds with regard to DCBS, I'm sure is going to be completely eliminated, if not reversed. I can't really speak to the bully because they indicated that they would have to increase by one-half FTE at a cost of $53,702, and part of that apparently comes from attorney general costs, and some of that comes from the half FTE. So I'm assuming that is reduced as well.
Okay. Other questions, Representative Merkley.
Madam Chair, JL, are we going through a process of getting a revised fiscal so we'll know that, or are we intending to move this today, Madam Chair?
Well, I believe JL has worked extensively with legislative fiscal.
Chair Close and Representative Merkley, all of this was done having made discussions with the analysts in fiscal and coming to a determination that, yeah, this would probably do the trick.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. Representative Gallegos.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2967.
Representative Gallegos moves the dash 2 amendment into House Bill 2967. Is there discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gallegos.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2967 as amended to the floor. We're moving to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2967 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. I'd just like to thank JL for the work that has gone into this bill. That was my concern at our previous hearing, that there might be a price tag that would be too hefty, and so I really appreciate we've been able to resolve that and that I can support the bill today.
Thank you. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos.
Aye.
Representative
Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Berkley.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts.
Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Chair Close.
Votes aye. Motion carries. Who do we have here?
Oh, Representative Kitts is here.
Okay, and we will, can we change the carrier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Representative Gallegos will carry the bill. Work session? And I'm going to open a work session, on House Bill 3322. Have the staff read the summary and call Bob Shiprack, Ed Glad, Jeff Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3322 exempts individual enrolled in apprenticeship program from waiting the week requirement to be eligible for unemployment compensation. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shiprack, Secretary of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, who has brought this bill forward. Over the several sessions, due to changes at the federal level and state law, we've been allowing apprentices to draw unemployment insurance for certain apprentices in certain programs while they're required to go to state-required schooling. The state requires an apprentice to have 144 hours of related training. We would call it classroom training, in addition to the hours that they're required to have on-the-job training. For some of the joint labor management committees, They have chosen to bring their apprentices into the schools once every quarter for a solid week. Some of the committees, like mine, go to school two nights a week, so those folks wouldn't be affected by this. Generally, these committees that do the one week at a time are local, such as Jeff's and Ed's, where they have statewide jurisdiction. And I guess the best example would be Representative Berard's apprentices in his area. They can't go to school two nights a week in Klamath Falls. There isn't a school there, so they bring them to the training center for a week at a time. They're actually put up in a hotel, and they go to classroom training. We've allowed over the years to allow these young people to draw on employment while they're in those class, the mandated classroom training, except for the first week of the year where they have to come in, which has been traditionally what we call under the unemployment statutes the waiting week. What House Bill 3322 does is effectively defers that waiting week period until they're truly laid off from employment, so that these young people could draw unemployment benefits for that one week while they're going to classroom training. There is no fiscal impact to the trust fund. The money would be paid by the employer, which they have agreed to do. Our employers are fully invested in this training program. It's important to the industry. They understand that. I want to also mention that, again, that the waiting week is deferred, not waived completely. It's deferred until you are laid off. So I just want to finish with just a personal note. I'm pretty passionate about apprenticeship. I went through apprenticeship with the electrical workers. The average age of our apprentices are not 18-year-olds coming out of high school. Their average age is about 26, 27. Many of them are married and have kids. I took a substantial wage cut when I entered the apprenticeship program in my trade. You work at 35% of what a journeyman starts at. So it's a significant burden. I had my first child when I was a first-term apprentice, and I'll tell you, it was hard to make ends meet. I had that first child, and Madam Chair, I had to pay the hospital, this is how long ago it was, $5 a month was what I made an arrangement with the hospital to pay them $5 a month, because that's all I could afford. And as I progressed through the program and got more money, of course, I paid my child off. But
would that be your daughter?
And Jennifer's very happy
about that. We're glad you did.
But it is a significant sacrifice, and if this is going to help a few folks, particularly in rural areas, some young folks that are trying to learn a career, and I just would hope you could vote aye, and I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Ed.
Bob articulated very clearly what our issues are, that those of us who have apprentices, my name is Ed Glad with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, I have to compliment Bob for championing this issue for many years. It is just a wonderful thing to see that the state is committed in this educational program for creating craftsmen of very high caliber throughout the state of Oregon. I think that throughout the United States, we are recognized in all of our crafts as having some of the best hands that work in the construction industry. And this is a piece that really is helpful, especially for those folks that live far away from the training centers, in order to be able to get their educational piece done, their classroom work done. I'm a Me Too here, so thank you.
Thank you. And Jeff.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Carlson. I represent Iron Workers Local 29 here today to support House Bill 3322. Everybody has pretty much covered all the bases. It is You know, one of the hardships for apprentices is that when they are gainfully employed, they have to be laid off in order to attend a school. Local 29 has had a classroom 4 weeks at a time since 1974. In fact, I was one of the I was in that first class where we went for a month straight. Anyway, this bill will certainly help the economic impact that these apprentices, young men and women, face when they have to attend school, so I urge your support.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, thanks. Bob, are you bringing us this, these dash two amendments also? There, we have some amendments.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that was another issue that we tried to work on. It's illegal. Those are illegal. We thought we could
we
work on.
We didn't know it originally, right?
we thought we could work something out for some other joint committees. The issue was taken literally last week to Washington, D.C., and there is a legal issue with that. And actually, I'm going to get a hold of Senator Smith and pursue that at the federal level.
A follow-up, Madam Chair. So will individual employers be charged?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
I want to emphasize this. None of these vocational statutes for the apprentices are those charges socialized across the system. It is to the employer.
Okay, thank you.
Other question?
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, we are in work session. Representative Rosenbaum.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3322 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3322 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Barrard. Aye.
Representative Berkley.
Aye.
Representative
Toffler. Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Absolutely.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Chair
Close. Votes aye. House Bill 3322 moves to the floor. We'll have Representative March carry his bill. Close the work session. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 331A. Have the staff read the summary. We'll call forward Pam Levitt and Hal Scroggins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 331A allows investment of public funds by public officers and credit unions, expands definition of depository bank and pool manager to include credit unions, and prohibits public officers from depositing in credit union sums that exceed $100,000. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We represent 104 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 331. I am providing each of you with a packet with all of our testimony, along with a support letter from the Special Districts Association. I will also submit some letter and material from the Oregon People's Utility District Association. And I understand you have a long schedule, so our panel will be brief and to the point. I'd first like to turn it over to our legal counsel, Mr. Hal Scroggins. Then we have two CEOs who want to address the issue from the local level, and then I'd like to summarize.
Okay. Morning.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scroggins. I'm an attorney with Farley, Wada, and Witt, PC. We are the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We also represent numerous individual credit unions throughout the state of Oregon, as well as Washington and elsewhere. And I will briefly do some technical summary of the bill and address some issues that have been raised in various other quarters with respect to this bill, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions. Oregon public funds law is designed to safeguard public funds that are entrusted to public officials in the state of Oregon. It does that primarily by limiting the places where those entrusted with those funds can put them. Anyone who's in charge of public funds can place those funds with any bank right now that is federally insured up to the insured amount, which is, if you consider both checking and savings, up to $200,000 per public entity. And in order to be able to deposit more than that with any particular bank, in order to be eligible to receive more than that, the bank has to essentially set up a collateral account where it can pledge various types of collateral that serve to backstop the funds deposited. If the bank goes under, then this collateral is there set aside in order to be used solely for the purpose of making payments on the public funds that are deposited with the bank. And the state treasurer's office evaluates various information that's submitted by the bank and the bank's regulator and determines the level of that collateral that's required for deposits in that bank. It can vary from 25% of the amount deposited to 110% of the amount deposited under current law. The thrust of this bill is very simple. It will simply add credit unions to the list of depositories that are eligible to receive public funds deposits. As amended, the bill limits the amount that can be deposited to $100,000 per public entity. So no individual public entity would be able to deposit more than $100,000, which of course would be entirely covered by the credit union's federal share insurance under the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. Like banks, the credit union insurance limit is actually $200,000 when you take into account both a checking and a savings account. This bill, it really ignores that and says that there can only be $100,000 deposited no matter what type of account it's deposited in. The result simply is that public funds managers will have increased choice in where they can put their funds. This bill does not force any public funds manager to put money in a credit union. It simply gives them the option of doing so if a credit union makes those services available. There are numerous different public entities that manage large and small amounts of public funds all throughout the state. Credit unions across the state have had requests from lots of these entities, many of which are small, irrigation districts, cemetery districts, districts like that, that have amounts of funds that may actually be less than $100,000 in the aggregate. And they'd like the choice to be able to put those funds with credit unions for better convenience and for increased rate of return. So the bill really increases the choice that's available to the public funds managers. It leverages the safety of the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund, adds an additional element of deposit insurance that will backstop deposits of public funds in Oregon, and it leverages the safety and soundness of credit unions in Oregon for the benefit of Oregonians and the funds that are managed by the public funds managers in Oregon. That's the technical analysis of the bill. I'd like to briefly respond to some issues and arguments that were raised on the Senate side in the hearing on this bill. The bankers argued that by making available credit unions as public funds depositories, we might reduce taxes that are paid because banks earn profits from funds that are deposited. They pay taxes on those profits. If the funds go to credit unions are exempt from income taxation. The flip side of that is that the reason that public funds managers would put public funds with credit unions is presumably because there would be an increased return. There's more competition, greater return, perhaps even greater return paid by the banks competing for credit unions. And there would also be savings in some communities, perhaps by increased convenience that's available from dealing with an institution that is headquartered locally as opposed to one that's headquartered out of state. There may be some loss in tax revenue. I don't think anybody has made any kind of estimates or analysis of that because it really depends on what public funds managers choose to do. But I would submit that for any loss of tax revenue, there would be some corresponding increase in return to the state through the individual public entities that are making these deposits. Another argument that was raised really relates more to the hearing that will be held on Friday than this hearing, but that is that public funds consist of tax dollars, and since credit unions don't pay income taxes, they shouldn't be permitted to take public funds deposits. Well, credit unions do pay property taxes and payroll taxes. They are exempt from the income tax because they are nonprofit organizations. They are chartered, our State Credit Union Act specifically says that a credit union is chartered for the benefit of its members to promote thrift and provide a source of credit at reasonable rates. And income that is earned by a credit union is distributed back to the members in the form of lower interest rates on loans and higher rates that are paid on the deposits. They are the essence of a nonprofit organization. That's why the tax exemption is there. Again, they do pay property taxes, and lots of the dollars that we would be talking about here in irrigation districts, utility districts, other local funds are raised by property taxes. And so the taxes that would be deposited in credit unions are in some measure taxes that credit unions do pay as well. There's another argument raised that mutual savings banks are taxed. Mutual savings banks, like credit unions, are organized for the benefit of their members. There are two mutual savings banks in the state of Oregon, and it seems to me that this argument really goes to the question more of whether those mutual savings banks should be taxed than whether credit unions should be able to accept public funds deposits. The tax exemption for mutual savings banks was taken away a number of years ago at the federal level by Congress and of course at the state level by the legislature. The reason that that happened those years ago was because there was a perception that mutual savings banks were not serving their original purpose that they were chartered for. That is not the case with credit unions. You'll hear testimony from CEOs today. There's ample evidence that credit unions continue to serve people and organizations that are not served by other financial services providers, and they serve the particular people that they're chartered to serve. And so again, this argument about taxation really goes more to the question of the wisdom of Oregon tax policy than where this bill is headed. Finally, there's an argument that was raised that credit unions simply don't have the sophistication to deal with public funds, that sometimes public funds come in and out very quickly, and it would be difficult for public funds managers and for credit unions to monitor this $100,000 limitation, and a public entity might wind up inadvertently having more than $100,000 deposited in a credit union, which would be uninsured and uncollateralized, and that might pose a danger. And to that I say two things. First of all, because of the $100,000 limitation, the types of funds that will be deposited with credit unions are not likely to be the types of hot funds that are moved in large amounts rapidly in and out of various depository institutions. It's more likely to be the smaller funds, the smaller districts, the smaller entities that are there either long-term or are there consistently at a level that is going to be less than $100,000. The second thing is that credit unions are used to providing close attention and personal service to the depositors that they serve. Credit unions are used to paying careful attention to the needs of their depositors and have sophisticated ways of doing that. Again, this simply to me seems to be a red herring. Credit unions will be able to serve the public funds needs of those who choose to place those public funds with credit unions. That's all I have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Hal, just to clarify, the Section 1 amends 294.035, which you said was the public funds law, correct?
That's one portion of it. The bigger portion is in ORS Chapter 295.
Okay. And that's where you have this $100,000 limit. So I guess my question is that the $200,000 that you mentioned would still apply to banks, but this would only apply to credit unions. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is a limitation that would only apply to credit unions. It was put in there specifically in order in an attempt to compromise with the people that opposed this bill and an attempt to address any concerns that the legislature might have about the ability to monitor deposits and the safety and soundness of those deposits.
Okay, thank you. Other question? Representative Rosenbaum.
The $100,000 maximum applies not just to an individual deposit, but to the total of all deposits. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, if I'm understanding your question correctly, the $100,000 limit applies to each public entity that would place funds in a credit union. So the local irrigation district could place $100,000. The local school board could place a separate $100,000. Those would be separately insured, and each would have their own limit.
Is that what I guess what I was asking is that limit applies not just to one deposit, but the total of all deposits from that entity with that institution. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, again, if I'm understanding the question correctly, the answer would be yes. If the local school board has 10 accounts in a credit union, then the $100,000 is the maximum that can be deposited in the total of all of those accounts.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ralph Goodwin. I'm President and CEO of Grant Baker Federal Credit Union and John Day. I guess for the sake of time, I won't read word for word my testimony, but I will try to summarize it for you. As Hal said, this bill is simple and straightforward. It will allow local taxing districts to deposit with local credit unions that are controlled by local volunteers. As you know, all the members of the board of directors of credit unions are unpaid volunteers. In the past, when we testified, the people that opposed this said that the market is well served and that there really isn't a need for it. I'd like to address that issue. Before you is a petition that's signed by all 29 taxing districts in Grant County requesting support for this bill. And I think if you think about that for a minute, that kind of addresses that issue, that there is a need in the marketplace for locally controlled depository. The other issue is the issue of taxes. If you look at the graph that's there, you'll see that in Grant County, our credit union pays more in property taxes than any of our neighboring banks. And most of the funds that are in these taxing districts are property tax dollars. So the issue that we shouldn't be allowed this because we're not paying taxes is just not valid. The other thing that Hal talked about is with this $100,000 limitation, it doesn't seem logical that we will have any impact on a $26 billion banking industry in the state of Oregon. There's only 100 credit unions in the state, and there's not that many taxing districts. One other interesting side note is that 73% of all the dollars that are deposited in Oregon banks are in banks that are controlled out of state. And it would seem that if banks in Minnesota or Ohio can be approved for Oregon tax dollars, that surely a credit union in John Day or Medford should have the same option. That's really the essence of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
I've got a clarification. When the banks or the opponents of this bill assert that the credit unions are not paying taxes, they're referring to income taxes. And the banks pay the income tax. Credit unions don't, correct? They're nonprofit.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, that is correct. We pay all the same taxes that any other business does, other than corporate income tax, because
sure,
we are not for-profit cooperatives. Our members, as we pay dividend to our members pay tax on those dividends. No one can acquire any wealth tax-free by belonging to a credit union.
And I understand. I just want to make sure that I'm clear, because when the banks say that you're not paying that tax and they're referring to that tax, it's factually correct, right?
That's true. We're not a corporation, so we don't pay corporate income tax.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The public institutions that make deposits under this law, do they become members of the credit union, or are they already members of the credit union?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the public entities would not be required to become members of the credit union in order to make deposits. From the credit union standpoint, I don't think if they are within the field of membership, there's nothing that will preclude them from the credit union standpoint from becoming a member. That would be a matter that would be up to the public entity. But this bill would permit public entities to deposit funds in credit unions without becoming members. And the Federal Credit Union Act explicitly permits federal credit unions to receive public deposits from public entities without requiring them to be members. This clarifies, I think the Oregon Act currently does the same, but this bill would clarify that to make it absolutely clear.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, just so I have the picture right then, can the public institution, do field of memberships generally allow institutions, I always think of individual members when I think of credit unions, do they allow other entities, other nonprofits or corporations or public entities to become members, and do those members then become borrowers as well? Could public institutions then borrow from banks? Is there any change in any of those arrangements that's embedded in this?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the answer is that there are differences with respect to federal and state field of membership and depository rules because the acts are simply different. The Oregon Act says one thing, the Federal Act says another. So I can't be that specific. In general, most credit unions, and the other thing is that there are different types of credit unions. There are community credit unions and occupational or associational based credit unions, and the rules are slightly different for those as well. In general, for a community-based credit union, an organization that is located or headquartered within the community could become a member of that credit union and could borrow from that credit union. In an occupational credit union, in general, again, an organization that consists of owners who are within the credit union's field of membership could itself also be eligible for membership. And any member is eligible to borrow from the credit union, although there are limitations on what the credit union can do in the way of lending to non-natural persons and specific limitations in what the credit union can do in terms of making business loans.
May I ask a question?
Kids?
I have the unique pleasure of being a member of three credit unions and two different banks, so I come at this from all kinds of different perspectives. If this goes into effect, what you are proposing here, to expand the parameters of who can deposit without being members, you got to help me along here. So we expand the parameters of who can make deposits into credit unions. However, these people that are we're asking, proposing to allow to make deposits, don't have to be members, as you answer Representative Merkley. I then am failing to see the distinction between, if we permit this, between what a credit union does specifically and what a bank does specifically. So could you help me see the difference? If we allow this, what then becomes the difference between the two entities?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I'd be happy to answer that. The answer is that this is more of a bill about public funds than it is about what credit unions do. And public entities are special. Public funds are special. That's why we have these restrictions on what can be done with public funds. And the point of the bill is to increase choice and availability for placement of those public funds. In terms of what credit unions primarily do, service to their members, this doesn't affect that at all. Credit unions will not be able to take deposits from non-members in any way that they aren't permitted to do now other than the public entities. Now, if I go to a credit union here in Salem that does not have a field of membership that I happen to fit into, a lawyer's credit union or something like that, I can't join that credit union. That won't be any different after this bill is passed. A business that is headquartered here in Salem that doesn't fit within the membership of any of the credit unions that are located here in Salem, it would not be able to deposit money in any credit union that it does not fall within that credit union's field of membership. That will be the same both before and after this bill is passed. Credit unions will continue to be subject to all of the same limitations on their field of membership services that they are now, both before and after this bill is passed. All this bill does is simply give public entities a choice of what to do with public funds. The reason that Congress recognized a federal credit union's ability to accept public funds without the public entity becoming a member, the reason that we think that's a good idea at the state level as well, is because credit unions are chartered to perform a public service. They are financial institutions. They are chartered to, again, promote thrift among their members and provide a source of credit at reasonable rates. They don't pay taxes because they perform that specific service. And I believe that Congress, when it passed the Federal Credit Union Act, recognized that part of that public service may involve taking of public funds as well, particularly when the public funds would be entirely federally insured. And that same thing should hold true here at the state level. So this really wouldn't change the mission or the charter or the ability and the restrictions on the ability of credit unions in Oregon to serve their fields of membership. They'll be subject to all the same restrictions they are now.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the panel. And we'll go to Ralph Goodwin and Casey Wheeler now.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Casey Wheeler. I'm President CEO of St. Helens Community Federal Credit Union in St. Helens, Oregon. And I also will keep my comments brief in the, for time's sake. Our credit union has been one of those credit unions that has actively lobbied for this for a number of years. The reason that for our active support pursuit of this particular bill is that because the local public entities in our field of membership keep coming to us, we have not sought them out. They keep coming to us and asking, can you do anything for us? The reasons, and I've asked them why they want to do that, besides, you know, the typical diversification of investments. A lot of them mentioned that they would save by paying fees by doing some of their accounts with us. And the answers that I've gotten from them are as follows. First of all, they want to do business with us because we are the only locally owned and operated financial institution within our field of membership. They personally know our volunteer board of directors and audit committee. They know that the funds will be used locally. The five banks within our field of membership are all headquartered out of state. Second, they are impressed with our long-standing commitment to community service and involvement because it is the right thing to do, as the Community Reinvestment Act does not apply to us. We are involved in over 75 local events on an annual basis. We also have a long history of providing free services to the nonprofit organizations within our field of membership. And we started this program a number of years ago because the nonprofits came to us and said that they were paying a lot of fees to other financial institutions. Could we help them make better use of the money that they have? We have also worked with the local school systems and the senior centers in providing financial education within the community. And finally, they told us that they want to do business with us and place some deposits with us because they know us and trust us. An interesting observation is that none of them mentioned that they felt that they would receive a higher rate of return on their investment. The fact that we do not pay income taxes is not an issue with them. We want to be able to serve the public entities within our field of membership with the same level of service that our members receive. We want to do this because they are asking us to provide this service. We feel that we can help them demonstrate that the funds they receive are being used locally. I urge your support of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question, please.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. 75 events at the local level, that's a lot, and I don't know... You know, we talk about loss of revenue. Well, we're all going to find out what loss of revenue means around here.
Yep.
And we've all been taking for granted things like the things you folks are doing in your community, and we're going to find out how valuable they are, especially in light of loss of all the state funds. Has anybody ever attempted to add up all the hours and investment and time and treasure of the folks that belong to credit unions across the state, and then compare it to any potential loss of revenue that we may
That's what I'd like to see, because 75 events.
Excuse me,
I'm over to the good bankers to tell us about their events, too.
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, we're very proud of the work that credit unions are doing in the communities. Casey referred to the Community Reinvestment Act that the banks are required to do under federal law. And because Congress, in their wisdom, said we don't need to require credit unions to do this because they're already serving their members, we started what we call Project Differentiation nationally. And we asked all the credit unions to get a list of what you are doing, because we want to be able to come to you and show you we're very important players in our community. We're doing this on a volunteer basis. And I have not compared hours and loss of revenue, but that's something.
Okay. I don't know about loss of revenue, but I can tell you for our credit union, we do keep track of that. And for 2002, between direct donations and giving staff time off to volunteer and work with organizations in our community, it was over $50,000.
That's just your credit union.
That's just in our credit union.
And certainly the banks in Oregon are wonderful community partners. I wouldn't want to imply anything other than that, but I do want to add that at the level that credit unions are, we're much smaller than banks. We do our service to the community. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt again. I'd just like to summarize for all of you. We are here in support of what we believe is a small little bill. The public deposits law is law in 18 states around the country. It's not a new concept. Again, we've had this discussion in our state for several years, and many of our CEOs have wanted us to bring this bill forward for many years, and we have chosen not to until recently. In the Senate, we passed unanimously out of committee, and on the floor, 22-5. We think that there are several reasons why this is important. We believe that it provides a better option and choice for our public entities. Federally insured local credit unions will provide additional option in the marketplace for these deposits. We believe it's a benefit to local communities because the credit union deposits would remain in locally owned cooperatives that are headquartered and make loans in the communities in which we serve. There are several public agencies that have these dollars, and we believe that it will certainly give them the option of depositing them in a credit union. On the amendment, I'd just like to say that we really felt like it was important to compromise and come into this session with an open mind, and we felt very strongly that we did compromise with our legislation. We would urge your support of this bill, and we thank you for your time this morning. We'd be happy to answer any final questions.
I think we will go on to the next, the other side of the issue at this point. Thank you so much. Call Tim Martinez and Dan Hempick.
Good morning, Madam Chairman.
Good morning.
Madam Chairwoman. Tim Martinez, here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. With me today is Dan Hempe, Chairman of the Board of the Oregon Bankers Association this year. I'll make some brief comments, and then Dan will follow if that's okay with the chair. What you have before you today is frankly the last battle, one of the last two battles, I should say, between the banks and the credit unions. These have been going on for many, many, many years, both at the state level and back in Congress. This is not, in our opinion, a small bill. It's frankly the last piece of business that banks have in Oregon by statute that credit unions don't. Credit unions today, and many of you on the committee are members, so you know this, but bears repeating, take deposits, have checking accounts, have business checking accounts, make commercial loans, make real estate loans, basically do everything that a commercial bank can. Their field of membership has broadened so much over the years that I would challenge anybody to go in any of their communities and discover they're not eligible to join one or more credit unions. The issue before us today is whether or not they should take public funds. We estimate, and we estimate this number through call reports, that there is approximately $500 million dollars in banks, community banks, in at this time, that in public fund deposits. The credit unions suggest that, you know, and I'll use their irrigation district, for example. An irrigation district could put, you know, $100,000 and that would be it. And that's true under their bill. But that same irrigation district could put $100,000 in 15 different credit unions. It's not, that would not be limited to that district to one deposit in a single credit union. They could go as far as they want. The bank that I like to use in Eastern Oregon is the Bank of Eastern Oregon. It's about a $40 million bank, $12 million of which is in public funds. $40 million bank is a pretty small bank. If you take out a significant amount of their deposit base through passage of this bill, that bank's going to be harmed. That's going to harm economic development over there. It's going to harm loans. I missed the first part of the testimony by the credit unions. I apologize for that. But frankly, I was up meeting the speaker's office to talk about our economic development package and how it's going to impact rural Oregon. Passage of this bill, I can't say it any plainer, is going to cause problems to community banks in the state. We heard in the Senate, we've heard again today about this compromise. Well, it seems to me a compromise takes two to participate. We have been historically opposed to this, and that fact that position can't change. When I have board meetings, and Dan may go into that a little bit, this is not a little bill. This is a huge issue. This is the final battle, frankly, between banks and credit unions. We are all in favor of competition. That's not the issue. Competition, though, has to be fair competition. And that cannot occur if only 331 moves forward. You need the companion bill, 3491, which we'll talk about on Friday. They talked a little bit about CRA, and I appreciate Pam's comments about banks and their involvement in the community, because we are, and we're not involved in the community just because of the Community Reinvestment Act. I'll mention one bank, because clearly if a bank is headquartered outside the state, that causes some issues. I don't understand that issue, but it causes some issues. So let's talk about, very briefly, U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank has 177 branch locations throughout the state. They employ 5,000 Oregonians. 53% of these branch locations are in rural communities. They've now reorganized, and I will be the first to admit that the larger banks went through kind of a period of time in the late 90s trying to figure out what their niche was, who they were serving, and there were some issues. I would love to bring George Passador down here sometime, the chairman at Wells Fargo, and have him talk to you about what happened when that first takeover or merger first occurred. But U.S. Bank has now organized into 5 community banking regions. Each of the regions has a president and a local board of directors who are responsible for making local decisions about the rates and banking services that are offered in their communities. I commend the credit unions for what they've done. 75 events is a lot. U.S. Bank, for example, has donated more than $30 million to nonprofit and community organizations, hard dollars, over the past 10 years. I would argue that they also give their employees time to participate. You see banks' names all over the state at different events. So $30 million in the last 10 years, that's just one. Last year in Oregon, 27% of U.S. bank small business loans were made to companies in low and moderate income areas. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that again on Friday. As kind of setting the stage for Friday, at least from my perspective, there are two banks in the state of Oregon that are formed under what's called the Mutual Savings Bank model. This model started approximately the same time as credit unions at the turn of the last century, or early in the last century. At that point, Congress gave them both tax exemptions. And, you know, saying you have a tax exemption because you're a nonprofit seems to me kind of a circular argument, but they both enjoyed that tax exemption. As the mutual savings bank industry grew and matured, there came a time where Congress took that away because they said, you're now a mature financial industry. We believe that the credit unions are now a mature financial industry and ought to be looking at paying their fair share of corporate taxes. I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Mr. Hempe and be happy to answer questions now or when Dan is finished.
Please continue.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Hempe. As Tim mentioned, I am chairman of the Oregon Bankers Association. I also am executive vice president of a community-based bank by the name of Pacific Continental Bank, which is headquartered in Eugene, a community-based bank with 10 offices in the state of Oregon, seven in Lane County and three in the Portland market. I'm here today to provide testimony as to why this committee ought to oppose Senate Bill 331. And it really is all about fairness. Competition, as Tim mentioned, bankers welcome competition. And on the board of the Oregon Bankers Association, which I serve as chair, it's made up of every bank in the state of Oregon. Every financial institution that pays taxes is a member of the Oregon Bankers Association. And we are one voice when it comes to this particular issue. Credit union public funds access is the number one priority with our board. But as competitors, each of us on the board, we're fierce in competing against one another for the businesses that we wish to pursue in our respective markets. And we welcome the opportunity to compete against credit unions, but it's about fairness. It's about the ability for a level playing field and the fact that credit unions, if they have access to public funds deposits, it's an unfair competitive advantage in that they're able to pay a higher interest rate than what we taxpaying financial institutions are able to. As their testimony provided, they're able to pass on their profits in the form of lower interest rates on loans and higher rates on deposits. Because financial institutions are paying taxes, income taxes, we're not able to pass on that savings to the benefit of our customers. It's also, in my opinion, a bad time for our state to consider any sorts of bills that reduces the amount of revenue that's available to support public programs and education. I'm very concerned about what the financial impact would be to our state in the event that there is a loss of deposits of taxpaying financial institutions that limits our ability to make loans that would substantially reduce profitability, which therefore reduces taxes, limits the amount of dollars coming into the state for programs. Credit unions do not pay income taxes, as they acknowledged. The impact to the rural communities is something that is a significant concern to bankers. As Tim mentioned, the bank in Eastern Oregon, where nearly 25% of their total deposit base is on public funds, that would limit their ability to make the types of loans to 25% of the clients that they're doing now. I would suspect that George Koffler, who's the CEO of the Bank of Eastern Oregon, would say that that would have a significant impact on his ability to serve that market. For my bank, Pacific Continental, we have approximately $13 million of public funds deposits of about $250 million in total deposits. It would have an impact if we didn't have those dollars available to lend to our community-based clients, but it wouldn't impair our ability to continue to serve our clients. But it would cost us more money because we would have to find another mechanism, another means to have the capital and the liquidity necessary to support those loans. So it would impact, again, our profitability because we'd have to pay a higher cost of capital for alternative funds to be able to make the same types of loans we're able to make today by using public funds. I think the testimony that you've heard from Tim, as well as what you've heard previously, as well as from me, provides enough information for you to understand that this is a serious issue, and it is one that the bankers don't take lightly. We, as I stated earlier, we welcome the competition, and we're very comfortable with going head-to-head with credit unions, but on a level playing field. With that, I'd like to close with, again, strongly urging you to oppose Senate Bill 331, and I, too, am prepared to answer any questions you might offer.
Questions? Representative Shoffler.
And thank you for all the good work you do in our communities first, by the way. I don't belong to a credit union. I bank at a bank. But, you know, on this level playing field issue, you know, you're never going to be on a level playing field because banks are for profit and they are not. They don't pay income taxes because they have no income. All that money goes back to their depositors. That's the theory, and I assume that's correct. So it's impossible for it ever to be level. And the profits that banks in Oregon get go somewhere else. And there may be folks that have in Oregon that own stocks in that bank, and they get dividends. That's great. That's wonderful. That's the way it should be. But it's never going to be a level playing field, ever. And as far as I've gotten umpteen emails on this. I just got 9 brought down from my office. And those that oppose it are all bankers. For obvious reasons there, but these are folks that belong or are members of special districts, school districts. These folks are acutely, keenly aware of the more aware than I am, of the revenue shortfalls that we are facing the state, and they're saying this is a good idea. So now either these folks are totally incompetent or negligent or inept, or they just want this money to be kept in their hometown. And that's pretty powerful stuff. So I'm struggling with your argument.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, a couple things. The level playing field first. Again, and we may be able to expand on this on Friday. Mutual Savings Bank has no profit, right? Has retained earnings. They pay tax on their retained earnings to the general fund. Brady Adams, who happens to be the president of one of these mutual savings banks out of Grants Pass, sent $1 million back to his depositors in December of last year because they are cooperative as well. That's the way they're set up. Somehow, the state of Oregon has found a way to tax them, as has the federal government. So you can tax on retained earnings.
Madam Chair, just before I forget this thought, there's two in the state of Oregon.
Correct.
I would love to see legislation saying those nonprofit mutual banks don't have to pay income tax, because I'll vote yes for it, based on what I hear here today.
I don't think we have that bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, we heard that same comment made on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as Dan mentioned, we're not here advocating to reduce the revenues that the state receives right now. If the legislature wants to do that, that's your choice. But we're not, the Oregon Bankers Association is not advocating, given the budget situation, that we further reduce revenues. To respond further to your comments about the local control, this book is called The Financial Directory, and it talks about, it has lists all the financial institutions in the state of Oregon. By city. And if I could take just a moment with the chair's indulgence, let's just start at the A's, okay? The cities I will read are cities that have banks, and yes, some of them may be headquartered out of the state of Oregon. They have banks that are staffed by Oregonians, and under the U.S. bank model that I talked about, the decisions are being made by Oregonians here in the state. Aloha, Amity, Arlington, Athena, Palms, banks appropriately enough. Let me just go a couple more here. Boardman, Boring, Brownsville, Cannon Beach, Cannonville, Carlton. I could go on and on and on. Cloverdale, Condon. The only city that I could find in here, and it is in St. Helens, where there is not a community, shall we say, bank, is St. Helens. But even in St. Helens, there is the Bank of the West, there's U.S. Bank, there's Washington Mutual Bank, and there's Wells Fargo Bank. So there is competition there. I guess, and I appreciate the Grant County letter and your comments on folks you're getting, I don't see the cities, I don't see the counties, I don't see the schools actively involved on this issue. I don't see them before you signed up to testify and say, we want this, we want our members to have this new option. Because I submit to you that, yeah, the local entity, the irrigation district, might make a little bit more on the interest rate than they are currently right now. But there's still going to be a loss to the general fund. I think that's the issue we're trying to make. What's been left out of this discussion today is the local communities have another option. It's called the state treasurer. There's a local government pool that they are free to put their money in. Does anybody in this room believe that the treasurer invests all those funds in Oregon? Of course not. He has a prudent investor policy that requires him to invest where he gets his best rate of return. So there is options in the communities right now. And I will tell you, the banks, at least the ones that I've talked to, many of them are paying a higher rate of interest right now, about 15 basis points, which is a little, what's that, about an eighth, a little more than an eighth of a percent, higher than the Treasury to keep those dollars as much as they can here in Oregon. We will bring you as much data as you want on what banks are doing in the state of Oregon as well. But does that address your question, Representative Shoffler?
I'd like to add on, if I could.
Thank you.
Representative Shoffler, Madam Chair. It's all about customer service. And that's what I heard the testimony from the credit union panel that they brought forward, is that who they heard from were municipalities, public entities that felt that they weren't perhaps being served as well as they believed their local credit union might. Again, that gets to competition, and if we community banks aren't providing the appropriate level of service, then that's why there other banks are formed, and that's the spirit of America, and that's good for all of us. On the topic of the level playing field, I agree with you. I don't think that we are even close to a level playing field for a number of reasons, and frankly, that's a battle that's going to be fought for some time. But I will tell you that, and I think that you've observed this yourself, and Representative Kitts made mention of it earlier, that he belongs to three credit unions and two banks. Credit unions were originally formed for the purpose of serving a common union, a common bond. That common union is becoming more and more blurred. We see credit unions today advertising as banks, banking opportunities, banking choices. Certain credit unions advertise that it only requires being an employee or a resident in one of 17 counties for ability to become a member. I'm trying to find the common bond that's there, as was the original intent of the formation of credit unions. So here again, there's an opportunity for credit unions to continue to grow and provide the types of services that community banks are able to provide at an unfair competitive advantage because of their ability to take what would otherwise be paid in the form of corporate income taxes and return that to their clients, which they happen to call members. But a number of the studies that we have done as part of the Oregon Bankers Association has led us to a clear understanding that many of the Oregon residents do not appreciate and understand that credit unions don't pay taxes. And they're looking for convenience. They're looking for service. When we asked, it was more research group that did the survey for us, asked about whether they were aware that credit unions pay taxes and whether they cared. One, they didn't know they didn't pay taxes, and two, it didn't have an impact. Now that concerns us as banks, because here my feeling is that customers, clients of the bank, they're looking for service. They're looking for access to financial solutions, which can be provided both by community-based banks as well as credit unions. We need to do a better job, not only as bankers, but I think as legislators, in helping the business community as well as all of the residents of Oregon realize that there are non-taxpaying banks out there that is impacting our ability to have the type of funding in our state to support all the programs that we need funding for.
I'm going to go to Representative Kitz's question, then Garrard, and then we are going to need to go to the rest of our bills.
I've got, I like Representative Schaffler, received numerous emails from bank presidents, but also from credit union presidents. So I think that's probably an even number. I think they have vested interest, so that doesn't surprise me. And I would encourage anyone to send emails and send them to rep.jeffmerkley. My question, there's always one on a committee, and I'm him. My question is, are all credit unions not-for-profit, and are all banks for-profit?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitz, I think the answer is all credit unions are not-for-profit, as indicated in their testimony. Banks, I get back to the two mutual savings banks.
Sure.
You know, one in McMinnville, one in Grants Pass, that is established, is organized as a cooperative, and therefore not profit.
Let me go to just part. May I do my part?
Part A, follow up.
Thank you. That being the case, it's really no wonder why if two institutions, let's just say in general terms, deal in money and are specific to what their mission statement is based on benefits that are given to one side, i.e. not paying, being a not-for-profit, they're limited in their scope or should be limited in their scope of what they perform, because if in fact you allow one entity that deals in the same as another entity but give one a substantial break and not requiring them to pay taxes, where do we draw the line in what, where it becomes blurred in what they do? Is that your argument before us today, is to say that by taking this next step, you're allowing credit unions to infiltrate, for lack of a better word, into what banks do, because banks pay taxes, credit unions don't. And if we allow the credit unions to do this legislation here and accept that it's the demise of the banks, because they then get to do everything that banks get to do, but yet don't have to pay corporate tax, and you're unable to compete because you guys have a higher threshold of tax liability than banks. Is that really the gist of the argument?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitz, yeah, I think that's exactly it. There was once a very bright line that distinguished banks from credit unions. That line is virtually non-existent anymore. And I would argue probably is non-existent, and passage of this just furthers that along, at least in Oregon.
And I wanted to clarify my three credit unions that I belong to. One is the U.S. Senate Credit Union when I worked in the United States Senate. The other one is the United States Congressional Credit Union when I worked in the United States Congress. And the other one is Fiber Credit. I'm trying to remember why I was a member there, but there was a specific reason.
It's because you had so much money.
Yeah, oh well.
Representative Gerard.
This is much more of a comment than a question. In that the entire dialogue this morning has gone from banks versus credit unions. Let me, if I could, just give the committee a viewpoint as a county commissioner who was responsible for making the kind of decisions as to where money is placed. It's not a question of who's more valuable to our various communities. Banks and credit unions are both a part of our communities. Both. It really upsets me to see you competing with who's doing most for your community. Gosh, none of our communities can do without either one of you, because you both play such an important role, whether it be economic development or helping the people of our communities. And who pays more taxes and this kind of thing? I'm sorry, it comes down for me as a county commissioner was a question of fairness. And that's why I supported this bill. Was that I felt, I mean, nobody at the county level is going to take funds out of U.S. Bank and move them to a credit union. That's just not, I don't think it's going to happen. All this bill does, I think, is give credit unions the opportunity to compete with banks for that money. But I don't see dramatic shifts of money from one entity to the other. It's just simply going to open the door for credit unions to be there. And they are part of our community. And I think from a commissioner's standpoint, I felt they should be getting a share of those public monies, just as the banks do. Now, and I, for that same reason of fairness, I'll also support 3491 for that same reason of fairness. But I just want the committee to realize that what we're arguing about is money, and that's a tough argument for anybody up here on this dais to take on. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd like to follow up on that question. We've been told that this is being done in 18 states. Do you have information? Do you know if there have been dramatic shifts in those 18 states?
Madam Chair, I do not. If I could just respond to Representative Girard, I appreciate your comments, Representative. You have obviously have an institution in your community that's very dependent on public fund deposits. But if I could just give you an example. Congress a few years ago, when banks frankly got their proverbial tail whipped after winning a Supreme Court case on field of membership, and within days we lost the battle in Congress, put in the ability for credit unions to make commercial business loans. And they put in a limit of 12.5%. Does that seem like of assets? That seemed to be a reasonable number of loans for them to make, given how they're structured and everything else. The very next year, different credit union groups were back there saying it's not enough. We need more. Now, I think it's only reasonable to expect that at some point soon, the credit unions will be back before a future business committee saying 100,000 isn't enough, it's got to be more. So I have a hard time believing that this is going to be a small amount of money. There's $500 million in community banks, there's probably an equal number in the larger institutions. Nobody in the financial business is going to try to get one or two accounts and say, okay, I'm done with that market, let's move on to something else. This market will be worked very hard, it is a very competitive market. Thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, panel. And committee, I just want you to know what I'm trying to accomplish here is to make sure that you have as much information as possible before you commit your vote and make your decision on these two bills. So we will continue this discussion on Friday. And I believe we'll have a lot of the same people back. So I would ask you to, I would advise you to not commit your vote until you've heard the entire testimony. And that should be concluded Friday. Okay, I'm closing the work session on... Excuse me, it was a public hearing. On Senate Bill 331A. I'd like to announce that we're going to hear Senate Bill 235A last and 253A last because they need to be amended. We need to reconcile them with other bills, and so that will be short testimony. We do not have those amendments. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 199. Have the staff read the summary. Call Floyd Lanter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 199 clarifies a cause of action against bond or letter of credit for certain providers of prepaid funeral services.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We have 15 programs over there, including banks and credit unions, so it's an interesting job. But I'm here today to request your support of Senate Bill 199. This bill clarifies existing law to assure consumers have a right of action against an endowment cemetery's bond or letter of credit. As a way of background, the division was assigned responsibility for this program in the beginning of 2002. The 2001 legislature decided it wanted an agency that was familiar with the regulation of financial institutions to oversee the program and transferred it to the department at that time. That was House Bill 2809 of the 2001 session. Prearranged funeral trusts are prepaid funeral plans that consumers can purchase usually from funeral homes.
perpetual and endowment care plans are arrangements that a consumer may make with certain cemeteries that will agree to undertake care of a gravesite in perpetuity. We license providers who sell pre-need funeral plans and pre-construction cemetery facilities such as niches and crypts. We also register master trustees. Master trustees receive trust funds from providers of these services and manage the funds until the pre-need care is provided or until a consumer requests a cancellation of the contract. And we currently have 215 certified providers, 75 endowment care providers, and two registered master trustees. Existing law contains an exception governing a person with a claim against a letter of credit or bond for certain providers of prepaid funeral services. Senate Bill 199 does not change policy but removes an apparent paradox in statutory construction, which, if you strictly followed it as worded, would deprive a consumer of a right of action against an endowment, cemetery's bond, or letter of credit intended to protect the consumers in the first place. So it's kind of a technical issue. It's fee neutral, and I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. I respectfully request that the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the House to do pass recommendation.
Questions? Thank you very much. Do we have staff? Do we have the Senate vote?
Oh, yes.
Maybe Floyd mentioned it. I'm sorry. Did you mention action in the Senate?
Yes. Do you need to vote? Is that what you're looking
for? That was what I was looking for. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I is 29.
29, okay. Thank you. Okay, let's see. We're in public hearing. Okay, that concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 199. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 199. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 199 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 199 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Discussion.
Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Geiga
is excused.
Representative Berard.
Aye.
Representative Berkeley?
Aye.
Representative
Koppler?
Aye.
Representative Kitch? Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye. Chair Close? Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Rosenbaum, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Now, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 199. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 200. Have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 200 requires master trustees to submit annual report to the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services, subjects master trustee to examination requirements, authorizes director to discipline certified provider or master trustee for insolvency, increases penalty for violating certification or registration requirements to maximum $5,000 fine or 1 year's imprisonment or both. Thank you.
And we will welcome Floyd Lanter again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. Senate Bill, I previously provided you background of this program, and I'll just limit my testimony to the issues of this bill, Senate Bill 200. It removes inconsistencies and clarifies provisions and intent of the existing law. To that end, it will require annual reports from master trustees as well as providers of pre-need plans, and will require master trustees to pay costs of examinations. It will permit the director to suspend or revoke certificates and registrations of insolvent providers and master trustees. It also makes the director's referrals to local and federal law enforcement authorities discretionary instead of mandatory. And lastly, it creates criminal sanctions for providers and master trustees who misuse trust funds. Adding these criminal sanctions reinforces existing public policy by providing deterrence to and consequences for violations of law governing trust funds, thus better protecting consumers of pre-need funeral plans from misuse of such trust funds. Again, this bill is fee neutral. I became aware of a proposed amendment to this at the beginning of the session this morning. The Oregon Bankers Association has a proposed amendment to clarify the definition of master trustee. I have not seen the amendment, but as I understand it in concept, I would not be have a problem with it. As such, with that proposed amendment, I would respectfully request that the committee support the bill as amended and send it to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Hoyt, have these amendments been submitted, or is that something that you would ask the committee to do?
They have been.
They have been submitted. They have not. Okay. I think that's a good idea. I think we do need that definition. So I will direct the staff to put that amendment in. And we will intend to put this on the Friday agenda.
Okay.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 200. And I'm going to skip 235. Again, we need reconciling amendments, so we will come back to that as time allows. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 248 directs the Attorney General to approve form of surety bond irrevocable letter of credit obtained by pawnbroker, modifies examination requirements for pawnbrokers, requires field examination and examination at Office of Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you.
And Floyd is still with us. We'll call Tim Martinez forward as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'm here today to request your support of Senate Bill 248. This bill clarifies and simplifies procedures between the Division and the Department of Justice relating to the approval of surety bonds for pawnbrokers, and changes how we regulate pawnbrokers to conform to a budget note that required the director provide a minimal approach to pawnbroker regulation. Current law provides that the Department of Justice must approve each and every surety bond before the director finally accepts it from a pawnbroker. And the law also requires the director to conduct an annual exam of each licensed pawnbroker. To these ends, Senate Bill 248 amends the law to provide only that the form of a surety bond be approved instead of requiring the Department of Justice to approve each and every individual bond, and clarify the annual requirement for examination of each licensed pawnbroker by providing for a biennial field examination supplemented with an annual report to be filed. We refer to this as a mail-in exam with the director by each licensed pawnbroker instead of an annual on-site examination. Again, Senate Bill 248 is fee neutral and has no fiscal impact on the agency. We've spoken with the president of the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association, and they support the bill. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. I respectfully request the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Floyd, although there's no fiscal impact, it would appear that this would lower some of the cost for DCVS. Is that correct?
Chair Close, we, in response to the budget note, this program has never supported itself on the surface. So what we had to do is come up with a way to reduce regulatory burden and reduce our costs at the same time, and that's where the mail-in exam concept came up. So we were able to reduce the technically assigned staff from 0.6 to 0.2 and still meet the requirements.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the work that has been done to try to do some streamlining. Questions? Representative Brewer?
No questions.
I'm sorry. Okay, thank you very much. Tim Martinez.
I was signed on the wrong line.
You are here.
Thank God, Tim.
You deserve a break. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 248, open a work session on Senate Bill 248. Representative Merkley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 248 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Merkley moves Senate Bill 248 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 He is excused.
Aye.
Votes aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would move that we place SB 248 on the consent calendar. If the chair approves.
Let's have discussion on that motion.
Okay.
No one is opposed?
It would be a fun bill to have somebody talk about. I'm with the representative.
Okay, I'm Representative Merkley. You want to amend your motion then?
I move that we I move that we place this on the consent calendar, Madam Chair.
Okay, and you did move due pass as well, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Senate Bill 248, the motion has been made by Representative Merkley to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation on the consent calendar. Discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. And that was the work session on Senate Bill 248. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 734A. Have the staff read the summary. And we'll call John Powell and Joel Arrillo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 734A modifies standard non-forfeiture law for individual deferred annuities, specifies minimum values for annuity policies, specifies formula to determine rate of interest for calculating minimum non-forfeiture amount. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing the American International Group and Standard Insurance Company. And in his absence, John Mangan, who represents the American Council of Life Insurers, and I have his testimony here, I'll hand it in. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 734 is really the work product of about 18 months at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC. In developing a model act that would deal with a phenomenon that no one ever thought we'd have to deal with. In the individual annuity statute, the non-forfeiture law, the guaranteed interest rate on that product is set statutorily at 3%. Well, as you know, right now, you can earn between 1% and 2.5% if you get the right time at the right place on short-term investments. What Senate Bill 734 does is that it allows the market, the interest rate market, Federal Reserve rate, to actually control this interest rate as opposed to just a fixed rate. And this model act is being passed in several states this year as a result of the very, very low interest rates. And as the legislature is finding out with PERS, an annuity is basically a retirement product where, and it's really the only product on the market in the private sector where you can buy this product and it'll provide that benefit for as long as you live, regardless of how long you live, and that's why they're somewhat popular. But if you pay out more than you take in, you're in trouble. And this statutory rate of fixed 3% is causing that to happen, and it will eventually dry up the individual annuity market. So the provisions of Senate Bill 734 deal with that in a way that the regulators have really come up with this solution. And with me today is Lewis Littlehales from the Insurance Division, who actually was the one who put the words to paper and use that model act. So if you have technical questions on Senate Bill 734, Lewis is probably the one, best one to answer those questions. With that, I would stop and answer any questions and let Lewis fill in the blanks if he would.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, you're right. We are struggling with PERS.
Okay, let's say I bought one of these a long time ago, and now I'm cashing in on it, and I'm getting the 3%. Is my return going to go down, or is this just going to be from people that purchase it from passage of the statute on?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffner, my name is Lewis Littlehales of the Oregon Insurance Division. This bill is prospective only, so it wouldn't in effect an existing annuity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I failed to remember to put that in my original testimony. You know how I feel about retroactivity.
Yes. Okay. Many of us would concur. Lewis, do you want to present?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Lewis Littlehales. I worked on this bill and it follows the NAIC model. It is the first change to the Oregon statutes in this area since 1977, and it provides an important update and makes our laws consistent with those of other states.
Can you tell me how many other states have similar legislation?
I don't know. Actually, I don't. It was just adopted, so I think that other states will be
moving at the same time.
Yeah,
I see. And you mentioned, did you say NECA?
That's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there's been a lot of work done on this topic.
Yes.
Okay. Questions? Representative Merkley, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. In Section 4 of the Act, there's additional language about annual contract charges. Are there other provisions other than changing the interest rate that are part of the changes you're making here? And if so, could you explain those?
So where?
Section 4 of the Act.
Okay.
But my key question is, regardless of whether in Section 4, are there other changes being made here other than just a change in the non-forfeiture interest rate?
The changes I think that there's a change in the surrender rate too, and that is that's cut in half, and I had my notes. Excuse me. I think that was the other change. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was the other change about the reduction in the surrender cost, which is the cost that the individual pays when the person surrenders the annuity prior to its being paid.
Can you clarify that? Just what is the surrender charge, and did you say it's being cut in half, so it's lower to the consumer?
Just yes.
That's the explanation?
That explains it.
What is the $50 charge? Is that something completely separate?
That's additional, and that's it's an administrative charge.
But that's a new... I'm sorry, Matt, do you mind?
I'll follow. Go ahead.
But is that a new charge? That's a new change?
It is, yeah. This section, it repealed an existing section and replaced its content with this material. And I believe that $50 is an addition.
One last question, I'm sure. Do these provisions establish a regulatory floor, but individual contracts that insurers may wish to have may exceed these? For example, a person might choose to issue an annuity that still set a guaranteed 3%. This is just saying that you can't do it in the state of Oregon unless you go below these floors. Am I understanding that right? This is not required levels. These are minimum acceptable levels for contracts in Oregon?
Yes. Yes, they're minimum values. In fact, that's specified at the beginning of Section 4 on page 2.
Thank you.
In committee, I believe that a lot of the fee information is in Section 42, if you're looking for that. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Beg that. John, is there wide support for changing the name of insurance agents to insurance producers? Am I going to hear from my district saying, now we have to change our business cards and our signs?
Madam Chair, that is actually a good question, but that is covered in legislation that's going forward this session, which is one of the department's major omnibus bills. And that is being done in the statutes in order to conform to some national standards of reciprocity, where they call people different things in different states, and this is an attempt to kind of unify that so that under reciprocity our language will fit with the language in other states.
Okay.
Madam Chair, that is in Senate Bill 253, which is a, and no, it does not affect existing contracts. They can call themselves, continue to call themselves agents.
I apologize. I had my bills out of order, so similar concept. Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was Joel going to testify? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 734A, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 734A. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 734A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 734A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos. Aye.
Aye. Representative
Berkley.
Aye. Representative
Chocolate.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. He is excused.
Representative
Rosenbaum. Aye.
Chair
Close. Votes aye. Motion carries. Representative Brewer, will you carry the bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Close the work session on Senate Bill 734A.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would move for suspension of the rules to allow a Representative Gallegos to vote on Senate Bill 199.
Representative Girard moves that we suspend the rules so that Representative Gallegos can vote on Senate Bill 199. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Do we have any motion?
Aye.
Thank you. We have two more bills. We are going to hear them briefly since we have 10 minutes. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235A and call, is Joel Area? He is here. Okay. Of the Insurance Division. This is sort of a dyslexic nightmare. We have 235A and 253A, so watch your numbers, everyone.
Madam Chairman, we have already confused the two bills several times in discussions this morning, so I'll try to be careful here. For the record, my name is Joel Larry. I'm the Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Senate Bill 235 concerns bank sales of insurance. It basically conforms the rules, the consumer protections in this area, to federal law. Oregon is one of the few states that has had a long-term allowance for banks to sell insurance. So when the federal law passed in 1999 that basically required all states to allow bank sales of insurance, it included a number of provisions about what could and couldn't be done in the area of consumer protection. The core of that law was the creation of 13 safe harbors. The federal government said, in these 13 areas, you are allowed to regulate, and that regulation will be upheld against a challenge. Any other regulation outside of those 13 safe harbors is subject to litigation on the ground if there's an argument that it discriminates against banks, in other words, treats banks less favorably than other sellers of insurance. So what we did in Senate Bill 235, which was worked out in close cooperation with all stakeholders, both on the insurance side and on the banking side, was to enact those 13 safe harbors in Oregon law. In some cases, that involved a restatement of prior Oregon law. In some cases, it involved additional consumer protections put into Oregon law. So that's the core of the bill, is to put into place the 13 safe harbors. It doesn't change Oregon law a whole lot. It does add some new disclosure requirements and that sort of thing that weren't part of Oregon law previously. The other thing that we wrestled with in the bill is what to do with other provisions, consumer protection provisions in Oregon law that were outside the safe harbors and therefore potentially subject to litigation. And on those, we simply worked with the parties to see which ones were likely to be challenged and tried to work through them as best we could. In the end of the day, we left in place other provisions of Oregon law that either the insurance interest or the banking interest wanted to keep in law, even though some of those are potentially challengeable under the new federal scheme. But we think this bill basically delivers us a product that will keep Oregon out of the kind of situation that some other states are facing today, where the insurance agents and the banks are kind of at each other's throats, and they're in federal court litigating over what are proper regulations and what are not. We think this bill will, there are some areas where that's still possible, but the core consumer protections will now have a statute that conforms to federal law. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. And did you want to speak as well on this one?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right, that concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 235A. I'm going to open. All right, we cannot go to work session. We have conflict amendments. And which is the other bill? That
253.
Okay, so these are the two that conflict with each other. All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe there also are some technical amendments that were improved in concept in the Senate and through, I think, inadvertence, didn't get into the A engrossed version. So those, I think, are forthcoming, too. They've been sent to LC, and you should have those by Friday as well, I believe.
Okay.
I have a question.
And I'm going to... Oh, Representative Merkley, let's see. We did close the public hearing. We're not going to work session. I can open it back up for a question. We have time. I'll open that public hearing back up so that Representative Merkley can ask the question. Senate Bill 235A.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I glanced through this, I noticed there's a lot of notices and forms that are being eliminated.
No.
You mentioned people being involved from the viewpoint of the two industries. If someone was coming to this wanting to make sure consumers were protected, are there issues related to these notices that consumers might be concerned about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, very good question. Yes, we carry the ball there, so to speak, for the consumer interest, and that was one of our key issues, was to make sure that in conformity to the federal law that no consumer protections of substance were lost. And in fact, I think if you go through the 13 safe harbors, in the end of the day, if you total it all up, there's more additions to consumer protection because of the disclosure requirements that are in the 13 safe harbors. Oregon, by and large, had the sort of two basic issues here. One is disclosure, making sure that consumers understand when they're in a bank context, they're buying a different kind of product than when they're in the insurance context. Particularly, they're taking on more risk with most insurance products. So there's a disclosure issue, and in general, the 13 safe harbors were stronger than prior Oregon law, so there's additional disclosure here. The other issue is anti-tying, to make sure that banks, which may be giving people loans and that sort of thing, and have some leverage over what other products they may want to purchase, can't say, I'm not going to give you the loan unless you also purchase the credit insurance from me, and that sort of thing. So there are provisions in here to prohibit tying of products. Those, by and large, we already had in Oregon law. There was some restatement of those, but I think it's a good question, and I think the answer is consumers are well protected here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235A. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 253A. And Joel, again, we'll have the staff read the summary on this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 253 replaces term of insurance agent and its definition for purposes of insurance code with new term insurance producer, and its definition authorizes producer to transact insurance on behalf of person other than insurer. Makes corresponding changes throughout statutes, allows insurance producer to charge certain fees. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Senate Bill 253A is a follow-up to a major reform of our agent licensing laws that the legislature passed in the 2001 session. That bill created a uniform set of standards for Oregon, and uniform with other states, and allowed for ease of non-resident licensing, so that Oregon is one of some 42 or 43 states now, I believe, that has a reciprocal licensing system that allows non-residents from other states to get in and be licensed in Oregon more readily, and also allows Oregon resident licensees to be licensed in other states as non-residents. What this bill does is sort of cleans up some of the technical issues that have emerged in implementing the bill from the 2001 session. One of them concerns reciprocity and exactly what rights we have and don't have to deal with states that are not reciprocal with us. There are still some states that haven't passed reciprocal licensing, so this clarifies our authority in those contexts. It also clarifies that in Oregon, up until these reforms, you can be an insurance agent representing companies, but you could not be an insurance broker representing the consumer. And the term that you mentioned before, insurance producer, now in this law is meant to capture both the agent and the broker possibilities. So we now have a wider range of capacities that are available to insurance intermediaries. And then finally, the other major section of this bill deals with compensation rules for agents and brokers, are now insurance producers. And what it does is relaxes some of the restraints on sale of product to commercial entities. It only applies to large commercial entities. That is, in the life and health context, groups of 51 or larger, and in the property and casualty context, companies that have a combined premium of at least 100,000. So we're talking about large commercial entities. And with those entities, we're moving from a system in which but with some exceptions previously, but generally only kind of compensation that an agent could obtain was the commission, and they had to take the full commission. Under this bill, we make two changes. One, we allow for competition on the commission, so the rebating law, which would still apply to individual sales of insurance and small commercial entities, would not apply to these larger entities, and so in a competitive market, commissions could be reduced in the marketplace. And in exchange for that, we would allow the insurance intermediary also to collect fees from the end user, from the commercial entity, provided that there was full disclosure of those fees. And one point that I want to put on the record and be very clear about is that the bill gives us the right then to set rules on exactly how that disclosure works, and we will have rules that make it clear that the disclosure goes not just to the fee part of it, but to the any commission part of it that is collected. So the person will know exactly how much the intermediary is being compensated, both on the fee side and on the commission side, under this bill.
Appreciate your extensive work on this. Questions? Representative Merkley.
Chair, thank you. When you're talking about rebating, you're talking about rebating from whom to whom?
Rebating from Madam Chairman, Representative Merkley. We would be talking about a rebate from the agent or the intermediary, the insurance producer, back to the consumer. In classic insurance regulation, rebating was not allowed because it was thought that that would involve discrimination between parties, but there are a number of commentators on all sides of this issue, really, who think that rebating, anti-rebating laws are actually anti-competitive laws that hurt the consumer, and particularly in the large commercial context, and so that's why we're relaxing that here. There even are some commentators who, Mr. Hunter, for instance, who's a very active consumer activist in Prop 103 in California, they got rid of rebating for all parts of the market because the theory there was that rebating actually operates to protect agent income more than it operates to avoid discrimination. So it's a somewhat controversial issue, but in this bill we simply attacked it with the large commercial entities, I think, that are quite prepared to defend themselves and in fact often do insist in the current marketplace on rebates even though they're not currently legal. So it's a leverage point for the consumer against the agent.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And again, committee, we are holding these over because they have to be reconciled, and we will be bringing them back Friday, perhaps. Maybe it'll be Monday.
Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 253. And I believe we have taken action on everything except 2710. We will not be acting on that bill today. Okay. Anything else for the good of the committee? Representative Merkley.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to suspend the rules so that Representative Kitts can vote on SB 199, SB 248, and SB 734A.
We're not going to accept that motion. Just kidding.
After Representative Kitts promulgated my email address all over the
location. Where were the bill numbers again, Representative Merkley?
199, 248, and 734A. With the committee's acceptance, Representative Garrard, I see you frothing at the mouth. I just like it to be known that it wasn't merely a meandering of me out there. It was me. It was the chair adjourning that last hearing and getting me stuck out there with the credit unions for all my questions. So I have witnesses.
Okay, Representative Merkley moves that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Kitts to vote on Senate Bill 199, Senate Bill 248, and Senate Bill 734A because the chair caused him to do it. It's your discussion.
Madam Chair, I'm a stickler for attendance.
This is the discussion, not the
This is the discussion. Oh. Is there objection?
Yes, aye.
One, two, the others. Okay, the ayes have it. And we, and the motion carries, and...
Madam Chair, I wish to change my vote.
Too late. Gavel has dropped. Representative Kitts, how do you vote on 199?
I vote aye.
248.
Aye.
Senate Bill 734A.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
And I will remember that, Ms. Madam Chair. Thank you. For a long, long time.
We're closing that. And we are adjourned. We're here for you.